Huge crowds are once again converging on Tahrir Square in Cairo, Egypt, to celebrate the one-year anniversary of that country's uprising, the one that ousted longtime President Hosni Mubarak. Everyone from liberal activists who are in the square chanting down, down with military rule, to once-banned Islamists, including members of the Brotherhood, who are checking IDs and policing the square, to supporters of the country's current military rulers, are there. The BBC's John Lyne says everyone wants to claim ownership of the revolution.
Now you've got obviously the revolutionary youth, the people who really were at the vanguard last year, who want an immediate end to military rule. You've got the Muslim Brotherhood, you've got the majority, or the largest single force in Parliament, and you've got the military rulers, who themselves also are trying to say they're the ones who protected the revolution, and they're organising their own celebrations as well.
On Monday, members of Egypt's new parliament took their seats for the first time. Only a handful of women were elected, and our next guest wasn't one of them. 29-year-old Dalia Ziada ran for office but didn't win. She's an Egyptian human rights activist. She's in Washington this week for meetings at the advocacy group the American Islamic Congress. She serves as director of their bureau in Egypt. And by the way, she translated an American comic book about Martin Luther King to help inspire the revolution. We're going to talk to her more about that. But Dalia, I'm sure you're disappointed you didn't win, yet these were the freest elections in modern Egyptian history. Is there some consolation in that?
Oh, yes, of course. Actually, you know, some things that I've been fighting for through my work and even before as an individual activist, it was mainly how to secure civil rights and women rights in the Egyptian community. Now, through the elections, I'm seeing civil rights is being secured, which is something so great. At least part of what we've been fighting for is now being achieved. Now I believe it's the time to focus more on women's rights.
And why do you think so few women were elected? They helped support about a third of the households in Egypt. We saw what seemed like sort of a burgeoning feminist movement when women were galvanized to hold that historic protest last month after we saw that videotape of the woman. She's now called the Blue Bra Girl. You know who I mean. Her
yes.
Shirt was torn off, and, you know, there was this huge protest. So why were so few women elected?
Unfortunately, this was something expected, and we were, like, trying to deny in Egypt that, well, women can make it till the very end. We had very high expectations after the revolution, after being there in the square side by side with men and, you know, like, sharing the same dream and dreaming about the same future. But what happened immediately after the revolution in March, when women tried to emphasize their rights by a rally in Tahrir Square, they called it 1 million women rally, it was, I believe, the first shock that women received after the revolution.
When you say it was the first shock, what was the shock?
Actually, when 1 million women decide to make this rally, they first of all, they were not 1 million. The number was much, much less than that. And when they started the rally in Tahrir Square, the same men who were, like, standing by their side a couple of months ago, they went out to the square just to tell them, you have to go back to your homes. It's not your time now, and you should not be here.
Yeah. That sort of reflects the progress in other countries, though, as well. We remember during the civil rights movement here in the 60s, women were disappointed that they didn't have larger roles. And then out of that came later the women's movement. But we remember, too, there
actually,
was...
Actually, that's what I believe is the bright side of all the gloominess we are seeing now in the women's rights scene in Egypt. Now, for example, organizations like ours, the American Islamic Congress, and other organizations working in Egypt on women's rights for years, are getting together and forming coalitions to secure a minimum of women's rights in the upcoming constitution and find ways to support women in leadership positions.
Yeah. One of the issues we know you want to take up is female genital mutilation. It's pretty much universal in Egypt. When you were 8, you've told us your mother told you to wear a white party dress for a surprise celebration, and then there was this painful circumcision.
Yes.
First of all, why does it happen? It's not in Islamic law. It's not a religious right that we know.
That's right. FGM is very common in Egypt. It has been practiced for so many years by Muslim families and Christian families and everyone. It's actually a social custom. And as you know very well, it has horrible psychological consequences on girls because usually the parents don't tell the child that she's going to make an operation or a surgery. So this is the worst thing about it. The people you know most are betraying you. It was not nice. So actually, I've been trying to stop this since I was 8 years old, and I've been exposed to it myself. Now, after, let's say, 15 years from starting this, I remember when at the very, very beginning, we used to speak about this with my colleagues in university to people in the street. It was really something unacceptable by the society. But now people are accepting it, and now it's even a national campaign. So I believe it's only a matter of time, a matter of working hard on changing the mindset. And this is what we need now in Egypt, to change the patriarchal mindset towards women.
Do you take encouragement from last month's decision by courts banning those virginity tests? Remember, there was such an uproar after military rulers gave virginity tests to women that they arrested. And so the courts then banned those tests. Does that, you know, give you some encouragement?
Oh, of course, definitely. Actually, I never expected the court will make such a verdict because, you know, the military council is now ruling. And if they did so, probably the judge who makes this decision may be exposing himself to danger or so.
Well, and just briefly touch on the future. We know in the coming months this new parliament is going to write the constitution. Now, the New York Times is reporting that the existing constitution will largely stay in place. There will be clauses that call for Islamic law as the source of Egyptian law, but also clauses that enforce religious freedoms, artistic expression. These have long existed. Some are interpreting this to mean that these ultra-conservative Islamists that have won seats in parliament will not get their way if those clauses stay. Do you feel secure?
No, actually, this is one of my biggest concern is that our constitution may not be properly drafted or written because it will determine our future for about at least 50 years from now. Another thing we were just speaking about, that even the women who are in the parliament now, they have won, actually, they are only 8 women, by the way, and they have gotten seats simply because they were on lists that belong to the Islamist parties. So these same women believe very much that woman place is the house. Women should not be competing with men in public places. So imagine how these women would be speaking about women rights in the constitution.
Yeah.
At the same time, the Islamists who are now form about 80% of the people's assembly, the parliament, are Islamists. And 20% of them are extremists, which means that they don't believe in civil rights or human rights. They consider them Western values.
Yeah.
So I believe it's our role now as civil society groups and civil society activists to stand up for our future, to stand up for making the right constitution. And don't let them just, you know, play with our future as they want.
That's Egyptian human rights activist Dalia Zaidi. We'll be back with more of her incredible journey to activism. And by the way, it involves Martin Luther King. That's the man who inspired her. We'll hear more in 1 minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking about where the Egyptian revolution stands a year after the start of protests in Tahrir Square. Dalia Zaidi joins us. She's a 29-year-old Egyptian human rights activist who ran for parliament but lost. In Egypt, she works for the American Islamic Congress, training activists across the country. She was hired by that group back in 2006 after winning an essay contest called The Dream Deferred, sponsored by the AIC's Boston office. We'll post her essay at hereandnow.org. And one of her first tasks for the advocacy organization was to translate a famous 1950s American comic book about Martin Luther King Jr. into Arabic. Now, she'd only just learned about King and was inspired by his belief in nonviolent protest. And Dalia, we understand you had even come up with an Arabic phrase for nonviolent protest.
Yeah.
You didn't have a phrase in Arabic for that.
True.
Could you just briefly tell us what that influence on you has been?
Actually, the best thing about organizations like the American Islamic Congress is that they have an approach that I think led to what we are seeing now in all the changes that are happening in the region. This approach is mainly about working with youth and women. I was one of the youth that the organization worked with even before they hired me. In 2006, I've won in an AC contest. And through this AC contest, I was invited to a conference in Cairo in August 2006. And this conference, for the first time in my life, I was introduced to the legacy of Martin Luther King. And this amazing comic book that happened to be actually one of the main tools that were used in our revolution.
It's amazing to us that somebody hadn't heard of Martin Luther King.
Yeah, actually, we have not heard about Gandhi, Martin Luther King, or those great people. They were panning such stories all the time. I remember the only person we knew about was Malcolm X, and, you know, like a hero or so, and he was introduced like an Islamic or someone who converted to Islam, and so it was not really related. That's why when I saw the Martin Luther King story, you know, this young man who were able to change the history of the U.S. and the whole world by having a nonviolent movement, you know, and the word nonviolent was also very new to me. I didn't know what it meant at that time, and after so, you know, intensive research and working on translating the comic book, it was one of the big challenges, how to turn this word into Arabic, you know, one of the big challenges of the translation. So we invented a two-syllabus word, which is al-la'unf. And at that time, I remember when I was speaking to, like, very intellectual people about this word, al-la'unf, or nonviolence, like academics and professors at universities, they did not know what it mean. So it was really funny. Now it's used everywhere. It's very common. And we have seen even inside, in the revolution, in the middle of the revolution, people were shouting like, Silmeya, Silmeya. We don't want violence, you know. So it was great.
Well, will you continue to take some of those things you learned when you studied Martin Luther King Jr., will you continue to use them going forward in Egypt? I mean, you know, military rulers are increasingly cracking down on protesters. Security forces last month raided the offices of several pro-democracy organizations, though not yours. You know, we've seen in other countries, I look at Syria, we've seen in other countries that nonviolence hasn't been able to hold.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, one of main reasons of my visit to the U.S. this time, or to our headquarters here this week, actually, is to put the program for the next year. And one of the essential parts of this program is to how to educate people more and more about nonviolent action and strategies, and copy other workshops from what we have been doing in 2007 and 2008, and learn people how to adapt with the new situation in Egypt. I believe in nonviolent action very much, and I think this is our only way out from the crisis we are in now. Actually, we have, you know, on the political scene now, there is a competition between military and Islamists, while the civilians, the young people who started it all, are completely out of the process, which is really shameful, and it's absolutely wrong, and we have to fix this.
Dalia Ziada, Egypt Office Director for the American Islamic Congress in Cairo. Dalia, we wish you the best of luck, and please stay in touch. I just want to ask you also quickly, are you studying the work of Gene Sharp there?
Have
you?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Oh. Definitely, yeah. It was this famous book, Moving from Dictatorship to Democracy, was one of the main tools we were using in training the people on nonviolent action and strategies, and even during the revolution, we were distributing it everywhere.
Dalia, thank you so much, and stay in touch, please.
Thanks, Robin. Thank you so much. Of course, I will.
And that's something. We mentioned Gene Sharp. He, of course, the former Harvard professor and Nobel Prize nominee based here in the Boston area, who runs the Albert Einstein Institution, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the study and promotion of nonviolent action. His books are read around the world. We'll post our story about Gene Sharp at hereandnow.org. And we have a program note for you tomorrow on Here and Now. In the intelligence business, they call it a false flag. But why would Israeli spies pose as CIA agents to recruit terrorists from a group called Jundala to attack Iran?
First, it's more likely for a group like Jundala to talk to Americans than Israelis. The second reason is, I don't think there's any doubt among policymakers here that Israel feels under threat from Iran and wants American protection, and this would pull the United States into the Israeli agenda.
That story tomorrow. And a leave-taking today. You might have seen Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords' appearance last night at President Obama's State of the Union. Today, she handed in her resignation letter to a teary-eyed House Speaker John Boehner, writing that she doesn't remember that day last January when she was shot. Six people were killed. And then, surrounded by friends on the House floor, she held hands with House colleague Congressman Jeff Flake as an emotional Debbie Wasserman Schultz from Florida read from Giffords' resignation letter further.
The only way I ever served my district in Congress was by giving 100%. I would add it's 150. This past year, that's what I have given to my recovery. Thank you for your patience. Every day I am working hard. I will recover and will return. And we will work together again for Arizona and for all Americans. Sincerely, Gabrielle Giffords, Member of Congress.
Asked about her daughter's future, Giffords' mother, Gloria, said, I think she's transcended Congress. Latest news is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and by Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu. And by the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston, with Isaac Julian's 10,000 Waves, a 9-screen video installation featuring Maggie Chung, icaboston.org.